they were running at their peak performance. They were employing about 400 employees, all of them good paying jobs.
The tentative plan to reopen Nikiski's Agrium plant. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, searching for natural gas in the interior.
The term is called a wildcat. This is a true exploration. This is a brand new hole that we're drilling in the ground.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Democratic and independent candidates critical of the majorities in the state capitol have raised more in campaign donations than Republicans since the primary. APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on how political leaders are interpreting the latest campaign finance reports.
Democratic leaders say the campaign reports filed Monday show that donors are rejecting how the legislature approached the state budget this year.
I think it just speaks volumes of how the public is starting to realize who's really at fault with the mess that we're in right now in Juneau.
That's House Minority Leader Chris Tuck. But Alaska Republican Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock says the disclosures put a spotlight on a different issue, how candidates who are running as non-affiliated are actually working with Democrats.
The vast majority of the so-called non-affiliated candidates are completely affiliated. They're simply trying to figure out a way to pull one over on the voters.
Fundraising can be crucial in determining whether the public learns about candidates through TV and radio commercials, as well as through mailings. Republican candidates raised $580,000 since August 7th, while Democrats raised $476,000 and non-affiliated candidates raised $201,000. Vincent Beltrami raised the most of any single candidate over the past 2 months. The non-affiliated Anchorage Senate candidate raised $95,000, while incumbent Anchorage Republican Kathy Geisel raised half that amount. However, Geisel has more than twice as much cash on hand as Beltrami. Babcock says Labor leader Beltrami's fundraising points to Labor's interest in maintaining state spending.
There's a massive coordination going on with the labor unions to funnel money into the races, particularly into Beltrami's race.
Tom Begich is an Anchorage Democrat who's running unopposed for the Senate. He says Beltrami's fundraising success reflects discontent with the status quo.
The campaign that seems to be doing very, very well is, in fact, Vince Beltrami's nonpartisan campaign. That's a clear rejection of Kathy Geisel and her level of leadership.
North Pole Republican Senator John Coghill raised more than $20,000 more than Democratic challenger Luke Hopkins over the last 2 months. And Juneau Republican Kathy Munoz raised the most of any House candidate over that time, and more than three times as much as Democratic challenger Justin Parrish. The fundraising indicates which races are drawing the most attention and are likely to be competitive. The incumbent Democrat facing an opponent who raised the most funds is Anchorage's Bill Wilikowski. He was out-fundraised by Republican Kevin Kastner after the primary. Other than the Munoz Parish race, the other House races that saw the most fundraising are between Democratic Representative Harriet Drummond and Republican challenger Mike Gordon to represent the Spinard area in Anchorage, Democratic Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins and Republican challenger Sheila Finkenbinder to represent Sitka, Republican Representative Lance Pruitt and Democratic challenger Harry Crawford to represent Basher and East Anchorage, and Democratic Representative Matt Klayman and Republican challenger Marilyn Stewart to serve West Anchorage. Political observers note there's still plenty of time for the fundraising gap to change before the election. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaska's two U.S. senators resigned leadership posts in the state Republican Party in denouncing GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump. Robert Dillon, a spokesman for Senator Lisa Murkowski, says Murkowski and Senator Dan Sullivan voluntarily resigned over the weekend as members of the party's state central committee. Murkowski on Saturday called on Trump to step aside as the party's nominee after a 2005 video surfaced in which Trump made lewd comments about women. Sullivan also withdrew his support of Trump. State GOP Chairman Tuckerman Babcock says Murkowski and Sullivan hold the committee posts by virtue of their holding elected office and would have those positions restored after the election. He says the party remains behind Murkowski in her reelection bid. One of Murkowski's rivals, Republican-turned-libertarian Joe Miller, says he's found Trump's words reprehensible, but takes him at his word that he is repentant. Miller is supporting Trump. The Agrium Natural Gas to Fertilizer plant in Nikiski has been taking steps to reopen. If it does, it could add hundreds of high-paying jobs to the struggling Kenai Peninsula economy. But that depends on a reliable natural gas supply, something that's far from certain. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney reports.
Mark Schaafsma worked in the maintenance department at the fertilizer plant in Nikiski for 32 years. And he was one of the last ones to be laid off after Agrium announced it was decommissioning the plant in 2007. He says it wasn't easy to leave.
I'd had plenty of warning. I knew this day was coming. I knew the plant was closing and that my career there was coming to an end. But when the day actually arrived, it took me by surprise how emotionally disruptive it was.
Agrium's Nikiski plant used natural gas to create fertilizer products. When it closed, it was the second largest producer of ammonia and urea in the U.S. Most of it was sold overseas to markets like South Korea, Mexico, and Taiwan. Schaafsma found other work pretty quickly, but the plant's closure shed hundreds of jobs from the Kenai Peninsula's economy.
There's a huge ripple effect. I mean, you look at what's happened in the so-called Rust Belt in mid-America. A lot of little towns have practically dried up and blown away because of the loss of industry.
After the plant closed, rumors about it reopening started almost immediately. Now, the speculation is bolstered by news that Agrium is seeking a permit to discharge waste from that Nikiski plant. In 2015, the company received air quality and pollution permits for the same plant. All three permits would be required for it to reopen. But there are other barriers. It needs a large, steady supply of natural gas. Agrium's manager of government relations, Adam Diamond, says the company has been in talks with Cook Inlet producers.
We're talking volumes, large volumes, right? That one half of that plant uses 80 million cubic feet of gas a day.
But there isn't yet that volume of extra natural gas flowing out of any of the Cook Inlet reserves. Diamond says Cook Inlet's natural gas discoveries in the last 5 years are what piqued the company's interest in restarting the facility.
There's still, you know, we believe there's X amount of gas in the ground, but that's very different than there's X amount of gas flowing through the pipelines.
The company would also have to spend an estimated $200 million to reopen the facility. To help the process along, House Speaker Mike Chenault, a Republican from Kenai, ushered a bill through during the last legislative session that would give the company a tax break if it uses gas from a state lease. For Chenault, whose district includes Nikiski, the plant could be a strong economic driver to the area's battered economy.
You know, when they were running at their peak performance, they were employing about 400 employees, all of them good paying jobs, and all those were local jobs. There wasn't a week on, a week off, or 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off schedule where you could live outside somewhere else and fly up here.
Those kinds of local jobs are important for industry workers who live in Cook Inlet. Mark Schaafsma's son, Andy, says a job with Agrium always appealed to him. Instead, he worked for 2 years as a roustabout on an oil platform. He'd spend a week at home with his wife in Soldotna, then a week on a platform on the other side of the Cook Inlet. Both men say the pressure on families can be enormous when oil field workers spend that much time away from home.
Just the flipping back and forth between being completely not there and then being there the entire time it takes some getting used to on both ends.
Currently, Andy works brewing beer in Soldotna, but he says he wouldn't pass up the right opportunity to work at Agrium. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the controversy over federal trust status for tribal lands.
The statute gives the secretary authority to take title into trust of any land located anywhere.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
An Alaska Native corporation in the interior is searching for natural gas to reduce local energy costs and provide jobs. Last week, ATNA Incorporated subsidiary Tulsana Oil and Gas Exploration started drilling an exploration well on state land near Glen Allen. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk visited the gas well to learn why the Native corporation has such high hopes for this project.
Daniel Lee, oil and gas development manager for ATNA, is showing off the regional Native corporation's new well.
What we're looking at currently is a great big blue piece of iron, which is a drilling rig. The term is called a wildcat. This is a true exploration. This is a brand new hole that we're drilling in the ground.
As the drill slowly descends thousands of feet beneath the gravel pad, ATNA is hoping it will find enough recoverable natural gas to power their community. ATNA Incorporated President Michelle Anderson explained high fuel costs are a big burden for interior Alaska.
To fill your fuel tank up here in the wintertime, for many people, it's as much as a mortgage payment in Anchorage.
The Department of Commerce reports heating fuel prices in interior Alaska are among the highest in the state. ATNA hopes natural gas will be a cheaper replacement. They also hope a fine will mean more jobs. This is ATNA shareholder and former board member Roy Ewan.
There's just no work out here. There's no economic development.
Ewan says many of ATNA's young people move to Anchorage or Fairbanks to find work. ATNA hopes a natural gas find will change that. Alaska Native corporations driving energy development is a trend worth watching, according to Tim Bradner, editor of the Bradner Alaska Economic Report. Bradner says in the past, private companies took the lead, while Native corporations were either passive partners or bought in later.
This is kind of a different thing. This is where the corporations themselves are leading the exploration and putting their own money at risk.
Fairbanks-based regional Native corporation Doyon Limited is also exploring for gas in interior Alaska. But during the tour of ATNA's drilling site, Lee says exploration means they might find gas or they might not.
Worst case is we get to our targeted depth and there is nothing there, and that's considered a dry hole. And with that, you kind of just reassess whether you want to move forward with further exploration wells or not.
Lee says the company chose the spot to drill because it's promising, but there's no guarantee the $11 million project will find what it's looking for. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Indian law is often complicated and obscure, but one bit of Indian law just got a lot more concrete for the southeast community of Craig, the concept of land into trust. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports on the first Alaska tribe to apply to put property in trust with the federal government.
The Craig Tribal Association wants to place slightly over 1 acre in trust. It's in downtown Craig, and it's the building that houses the tribal offices. Parts of it are leased to the Head Start program and the Alaska court system, and it has a big hall the tribe rents for weddings and dinners. Craig Tribal President Clinton Cook Sr. says if the Interior Secretary agrees to take the tribe's building and the adjacent parking lot into trust, the tribe of about 450 will be better able to chart its own future.
The goal for all tribes are to be able to be self-determined away from the state and the municipality telling you what you can do with your land.
Tribal lands held in trust have a legal status similar to Lower 48 reservations. Trust lands are free of some types of state and local regulation, exactly which is a complicated question. Cook says the tribe has no plans to change the use of the property, but they have pondered some ideas. Among those ideas is gaming.
There's really no gaming in Craig. Because of the, if you do have a gaming, you have to file through the state and the city and get a gaming license, and you're subject to lots of taxes. Land in trust will eliminate a lot of tax burden on a casino or a gaming.
Cook says they've also thought about retail opportunities.
The marijuana business is something that has been touched upon by our tribal council, but just talking about it doesn't mean we're going that way. It means it'll allow us to do this with land in a trust.
The federal rules allowing Alaska land in trust have been on hold due to a legal challenge, but the state dropped its opposition, opening the door for tribes to begin applying. Cook says he thinks the BIA officially received the Craig application first because there's little or no opposition in the city of Craig, which has a population of about 1,200. The tribal president says he doesn't know if the municipality objects. The city already exempts nonprofits and the tribe from its tax rolls, so he doesn't think the city would be hurt by the change. The Craig City Administrator declined to be interviewed for this story, saying he wanted to hear the tribe's intentions first. The idea of having pockets of Indian country around Alaska is certainly controversial in some circles. Don Mitchell is an Anchorage attorney and author. He's become the archenemy of many Native advocates because he disputes the legality of tribal sovereignty in Alaska. He says the Craig application illustrates that the potential impact isn't just to distant acreage.
One thing that people do not understand is that the statute gives the secretary authority to take title into trust of any land located anywhere. So in this case, the first example out of the block is down in the southeast Alaska community of Craig. It could just as easily be in downtown Anchorage.
The BIA has asked for comments on the Craig proposal. The agency is accepting them through the first week of November. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
School district officials held a public meeting last night at a North Pole elementary school to discuss changing the school's name. Badger Road Elementary is named after Badger Road, which was named for area pioneer, farmer, politician, and pedophile Harry M. Badger, who was convicted of raping a 10-year-old girl a century ago. KUAC's Robin reports.
About 20 people sat with the three school board members and district superintendent who came to discuss the potential name change. School board member Mike O'Brien told the group, "It's never too late to do the right thing in removing a criminal's name from the school." But resident Sherry Renson says the community identifies itself through the road.
We want the identification of our area, our geographical area, to remain intact with the school.
In the 70s, elementary student numbers boomed all over the borough during and after construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. 500 children from homes along Badger Road were shuffled into the old McKinley Junior High building on Fort Wainwright. It was called the Elementary School for Badger Road Kids, so the words Badger Road Elementary School were more a description than a title. It wasn't formally named until a new building was finished for the school in the early 80s. For about a month in the summer of 1982, the school was named the Harry M. Badger School. After approving that name, the school board immediately rescinded it at their next meeting, and the school continued to be called after the area where the students reside.
Badger Road is named after Harry, pedophile. It is, and maybe because he had the money, he built the road. We built the school, we all live here. But the problem is we identify with Badger Road. We don't identify with the bad man that grew strawberries.
The district has posted on its website articles about Badger's crime, his guilty plea, his rape conviction, and the community outrage at the lenient sentence he received. There is a policy that schools not be named for criminals. So school board member O'Brien was asked where he would draw that line. For example, if Barnett School, named after early Fairbanks mayor and scoundrel, E.T. Barnett, would also be granted a name change.
I think there is a line there somewhere. My personal belief is that a pedophile is on the other side of that line for an elementary school.
The school board has had a lot of input through email comments, but this was the first community meeting. Board President Heidi Haas says it will be on the board's agenda in November. I'm Robin, reporting for KUAC.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The Alaska Marine Highway System is paying more than $1,200 a day for long-term storage of two unused ferries. One critic says it would be better to sell them than to tie them up. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The state has awarded contracts totaling more than $450,000 to tie up the ferries Taku and Chiniga for the next year. The ferry system already docks a number of ships each winter when lower passenger numbers drop the demand. But this is different. Ferry spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says they're being completely shut down and emptied of fluids. He says the Taku is being towed to a storage site in Ketchikan's Ward Cove. The Chiniga is headed to Tacoma.
The vessel will be unmanned. That's part of the cost, is that the company will be in charge of the vessel's keeping.
Ferry managers have a clear take on the future of the Taku. They plan to sell the 50-year-old mainline vessel, which can hold up to 350 passengers and 50 cars or trucks. But Woodrow says that will take a while.
It's not just listed on eBay tomorrow. There is a process to go through procurement, and we're working on that process.
eBay is how the Bartlett, a smaller ferry, was sold in 2003. The Chiniga's future is less clear. It's much younger, beginning service only 11 years ago. It has a smaller capacity, 210 passengers and about 30 vehicles. And unlike the Taku, it has no staterooms or cafeteria. The Chiniga and its sister ship, the Fairweather, were designed to provide faster, shorter sailings that some predicted would be the future of the marine highway system.
No discussion of selling or of retiring the Chiniga at this point, or either of the fast ferries. The only ship we're looking at right now is the Taku.
It doesn't make any sense.
Petersburg's Dave Kensinger owns a regional produce business that depended on the ferry system before service cuts made it impractical. He's also a member of a committee coming up with a new marine highway management structure.
We don't have enough money, and we probably won't have enough money in the future to maintain and operate the fleet that we currently have. So at some point, you just have to cut your losses.
He likes the fast ferries, but he says their fuel and maintenance costs are just too high. The one-time $450,000 price for tying up the Taku and Chiniga includes some towing and setup costs. Future years, if they're needed, will cost about 25% less. And Woodrow says the storage fee will be prorated when one or both ships are sold or returned to service. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
It started as a feminist magazine, and in the last 24 years, Alaska Women Speak has grown with the times and the topics that are important to women. Carmen Davis is one of the volunteers that has kept the publication thriving. She says at a recent retreat, supporters reimagined its mission and changed the size, but maintained its print persona.
We believe it's important because we work to reach all of Alaska, and it's some of our readers don't use the computer, so they like to have a hard copy. A lot of women with the we've reformatted the journal so that it fits easily in a purse, because that's what part of our feedback was, that a woman could take it, put it in her purse, and then jump on the plane and have some reading material.
The theme for the fall issue that's out now is landscapes. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the themes are selected by from our readers, and this was one that we got really hit hard with a lot of submissions. We were so excited. Alaska has plays a significant role in our lives here, our sense of place and our context, and so. We really received a great deal of submissions, and this particular issue, actually the cover, features Linda Infant Lyons' Autumn in the Valley. And Linda is, of course, an artist, but she's also her degree is in biology. And so that's connected with one of the book reviews, which is Becoming Earth by Eva Solaitis, who was also a biologist. So that kind of speaks a little bit to the landscapes theme.
Tell us about what's in each issue. It's fiction, it's poetry. What's all within the covers?
So a mix of poetry and prose, and then also images. And we've also added the book reviews as of the last couple of issues. And we're actually contacted by Red Hen Press to begin reviewing some of their publications. So we're real excited about that. And then looking to the future, we will probably be adding interviews of Alaskan women.
In the winter edition, there's a call for submissions for that going out now. Tell us about that.
Yes. So the theme for our winter submissions is ice chipping. And we're open to prose, poetry, essays, nonfiction, and book reviews. And those are due November 15th.
Carmen, people don't get paid for submissions, but they do get the benefit of some expert editing and feedback. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So if you're to submit a piece, our prose editor or poetry editor will give you feedback, and they'll point out some of the strengths in your writing, as well as some suggestions for shaping it or change, modifying it, improving it. So it's really an optimal opportunity for the writer who's emerging and looking to develop their piece.
Carmen Davis is one of the volunteers that helps ensure the magazine Alaska Women Speak continues its tradition of highlighting the stories, poetry, and artwork of Alaskan women. Links for submission information is at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Ed Schoenfeld, and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Robin in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/we are. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.